Today's program is dedicated to all of America's veterans and worldwide veterans. We're going to be talking today about the Japanese Zero Fighter. So we want to dedicate the program to the naval pilots of Japan during World War II.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. What a program we've got lined up for you today.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a big surprise. You know, we keep talking about American veterans and the great things that they've done and the dedication and everything that they have to their service. Today we're going to take a look at the Japanese naval pilots of World War II. Now, before everybody gets all upset about the Japanese and so forth, these were warriors just like American warriors. Politics had nothing to do with the pilots. They just wanted to fly. And I can certainly relate to that as I'm wearing my aviation shirt today and talking to some of my friends. So we're going to be talking later on with Dan King, the author of The Last Zero Fighter. So I strongly encourage you to hang in there. And I think you're going to find this story really fascinating. We also have a lot of things going on around the world, actually. And there's a big event going on here at WDEO. And because we love WDEO so much, we want to promote their fundraiser, which is coming up next weekend. So, Bob, what's going on?
Oh, thank you very much, Dale. The Colin Ray Concert is coming up next week, next Saturday. We come today at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Colin Ray is a country and western star. Not right, Dale? You said you knew a little bit about him?
Just a little bit. Yeah,
okay.
Heard of him.
Yeah, and Hill Auditorium is a wonderful place to hear a concert. Part of the University of Michigan's performing arts venues.
It's the most acoustically perfect building in the Midwest.
It has horrible seating, though, up in the balcony.
No, they've redone all the seating.
You always feel like you're going to fall over.
Short knees.
But anyway, the Colin Ray Concert is going to be next week. It's going to be celebrating the 15th anniversary of Ave Maria Radio. And I remember when we came aboard 5 years ago, we weren't here too long when we were part of their 10th anniversary. 10, right. 10th anniversary phone-in
drive. Right. Well, we're more than happy to help promote WDEO because they've been a great home for us. And so how do they get tickets for this, Bob?
Well, they're going to want to get with Tom Lowy, who happens to be the Director of Development. Now, I'll get your pencils out there. You should always have your pencil. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Yes, always have your pencil out. It is his email. Here we go. T. Lowy. T as in Tom, L as in
Lowy,
and Lowy, O as in Omega, E as in Echo, W as in Whiskey, E as in Echo, at AveMariaRadio.net. Now, it doesn't matter what religion you are, you're going to want to hear this concert. It's going to be a full orchestra behind this person. And Mr. Lowy, when you email him, he will give you all the information as to how to find available tickets. They're $15, I believe. Wait, 18. There we go. They're $18.
I think you can also probably find out information if you go to AveMaria.net on their website as far as their fundraiser. This is one of their big fundraisers for the year, and we want to encourage everybody, especially in the local area, to come on out and celebrate with WDEO.
Because they have a mission here. They're like us. There is a mission, and we want to keep that mission on the air. We have been so fortunate to have a home that we do right here at WDEL and with the Ave Maria Network. So, folks,
come on out.
Come on out or email Mr. Lowy and make a donation. You can't make the concert, but you certainly can make a donation. So,
right. If you like what's going on WDEL on Veterans Radio,
bingo.
Go right to WDEL and click on Donate Now.
And tell us, because we did have a listener that gave us contact information. Oh, this made my week. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. I have to say, we on our website, veteransradio.net, there's a little click up in the corner there, and it just says contact us. Well, I got a contact here from, as soon as I can find it, the magic of computers, is, I have to do the accent, right? This is from Australia, from Craigieburn, Vict, Australia, Richard Gold, G-O-O-L-D. And Richard, if you're listening, thanks very much for the contact, but he has no suggestion. He says, now I listen to Veterans Radio online from Victoria, Australia. Keep up the good work. Australia and the USA, side by side in peace and war. God bless both of our country's troops. He was looking for information on one of the program that we did on Typhoon Cobra.
Great program.
And went there, and he wanted to know where he could get a hold of the books. So for the author of Typhoon Cobra, here you go. For the authors out there that have been on the program, we hope that you've seen some
people. And he did buy the books. He bought two books.
I know. I know.
Halsey's Typhoon and the book Typhoon.
So, for those of you that want to market your books, what a great opportunity. Just contact us here at Veterans Radio, and we'll be talking to you, just like we are with Dan King today, and just like Dwight Zimmerman. Oh, I wanted to really throw some kudos out to Dwight Zimmerman's latest book about Lincoln. Is moving up the charts on Amazon.com. And he's very excited, as are we. And in fact, Dwight will be on next week with his At Ease program, where he talks to various authors
part of our network
about their book, and is part of the Veterans Radio Network as we try to grow. And I want to make sure that people are aware of all the things that we're trying to do. So if you have some stories that you want us to tell, make sure you contact us, and we will do everything that we can to try and get your story on the air. Remember, we only have 50 weeks a year, and so we try to plug them in as much as we can along the way. And in fact, there's another great program coming up, or actually another, what do you call it, event. I should have the drum roll. The drum roll is that coming up on September 14th down at Gros Isle Airport, they are having their vet gala. And it's going to be, they're focusing on a special tribute to the Vietnam era veterans. It seems like the past and present, and it seems like some Vietnam veterans are finally getting their due from a lot of different places. But this is September 14th from 5 to 10, fireworks, weather permitting, on Gros Isle, and it's the annual Veterans Gala. And I remember they did this last year. To find out more information about this, this is sponsored by the VFW Post 7310. And NASGIVETS.org. And you can find out more information about this. And the tickets are $18.50, which includes food. And you just go to VetGala.org. That's VetGala.org, September 14th.
I was there last year. And it's a cool event. That Gros Isle is where the World War II, what was it, the pilots were trained?
There was some sort of a training thing. Actually, in host on Veterans Radio, Ken Rogie, was stationed there for a while.
Okay.
And they do a great thing. They've got airplanes, they've got static displays, all types of different things.
And they still have the buildings back from World
War II. Well, because they have a little airport there on the end of the island.
And it hasn't been gentrified.
Not entirely.
No.
I have a good friend who teaches down there on Gros Isle.
That's a cool event. Why don't you give that contact info again.
VetGala.org. VETGALA, VetGala.org, September 14th.
Cool things. Cool
Friday,
things are happening.
Friday evening, fireworks, weather permitting. Gros Isle Airport, hangar number one. Thanks for the contact on that information. We're going to be going to a break, and when we come back, we've got Dan King on the program today talking about the last Zero Fighter. You are listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We want to welcome our guest today in just a moment. First, I'm going to introduce him. His name is Dan King, and Dan has written a great story called The Last Zero Fighter, and there's a lot of love involved in this, and he went out and he interviewed a number of surviving Japanese naval pilots and talked about their careers prior to World War II and also their adventures and scary times during World War II. And I think I found it a fascinating read, and I'm encouraging all of our listeners out there, when you get the opportunity, to check out this book, The Last Zero Fighter. You know, I was talking with Bob a little bit earlier, and we were saying what we have learned here on Veterans Radio, not just the superficial stories about heroes and you know, what happened during World War II and Korea and Vietnam and so forth, but we're finding out the inside stories of what these men and women were really like. And so I want to welcome Dan King to Veterans Radio. And Dan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
It is my pleasure. The story here, and I'll let Dan tell more of it, obviously, as we go along, but The Last Zero Fighter follows a number of naval pilots as they experienced growing up during the 1930s, joining the Japanese Navy, training, and finally heading off to war. You spent a lot of time interviewing these pilots, and I want to know, how did you come across this idea of doing this book?
Well, you know, I first went to Japan in 1981 as a summer exchange student, and I knew nothing about the country, and I had little understanding, you know, about their veterans or World War II in general, you know, being a kid. And I actually I met a Japanese veteran, and he was so different than anything I had ever imagined or expected. Mm-hmm. And it kind of sparked my interest and wanted to learn more about them. And so I went back and I got my degree in Japanese from Cal State LA, and lived in Japan for 10 years, working for Toyota Motors. And I met a lot of veterans, including the infamous Subaru Sakai. I interviewed him in his home. And after talking to him for several hours, I decided I need to start recording and documenting these guys' stories because they're so interesting.
I think it sounds very similar to when we sit down with the World War II veterans here on Veterans Radio, or before we even started the program, and kind of the impetus to get us going on Veterans Radio was talking to some World War II pilots and finding out, you know, what they were really like. Mm-hmm. Not what we had heard, you know, through the newspapers and radio or seen in the movies, but they're
right.
Just, you know, they're just real people that got...
That hit me when you talked about dreaming of flight, or, you know, being a young boy, thinking of wanting to become a pilot someday. You know, my own dad flew in B-29s, and he told me stories about being a little kid on the farm in Iowa and looking up at the sky and seeing the biplanes and planes fly overhead and wanting to, you know, fly someday. And this is the exact same thing that every Japanese pilot told me.
Mm-hmm.
That they were little kids growing up in Japan on a farm or near an air base, or an uncle or a relative had taken them to see an air show, and they were hooked. And they just loved talking about flying. And so I wanted to convey that these guys the dream of flight knows no boundaries.
Right, absolutely.
All people like to fly, so I wanted to record their comments and their experiences in this new book.
Well, I think what's interesting, and what I'd like to kind of set up, for those of you in the audience who would like to ask Dan a question about The Last Zero Fighter, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. Give us a call if you have a question about these Zero Fighters. And Dan, I want to kind of give our audience a little history lesson here. Can you, just briefly, if you could tell us a little bit about what was going on in Japan during the 1930s when most of these pilots we're going to talk about a little bit later got involved in flight?
Well, you know, the Japanese had been involved in a lot of wars. Pretty much they were at war from the time they came out of the, you know, medieval period. They were fighting with the Chinese and the Russians and the Koreans, and they even joined us on our side in World War I. And as these five pilots were growing up, they heard all kinds of stories from their fathers and grandfathers and uncles about the glories of war. And you know, Japan was finding herself in China, trying to expand her borders and doing something similar to what the Germans did, trying to grab more living space for their people. But these five men, you know, they were just teenagers. you know, growing up, and they had no political aspirations. And you know, in this book, I don't address any kind of political issues. This is just about aviation, and just about their personal experiences. And many of them were involved in really amazing battles. We have Pearl Harbor. Well, first of all, we have the USS Panay in 1937. One of the men, Mr. Harada, he's the last surviving member of the combined 12th and 13th air groups that attacked the USS Panay in Nanking in 1937. He's very last surviving member. And in the book, he describes, you know, why they attacked the Panay, and what their understanding was, and the ramifications of attacking, you know, this riverboat. And he also talks about bombing the city of Nanking and what he observed immediately afterwards of entering the city. To, you know, he always talked about wanting to examine his bomb hits and to see, you know, his bombing rate and see how effective his bombs were. So he took a truck into Nanking a couple days after the city fell, and he described what he saw and the feelings that he felt. And what I was amazed is that I'm sitting in his home, I'm interviewing him, and I'm recording his, you know, on my recorder there. And I stop it and I say, Mr. Harada, you're telling me things that are quite disturbing. Do you want me to stop the tape for a moment? And he looked at me and he said, I saw those things. They happened. No one could deny they did. And he said, turn your machine back on. So I did. And I think what he was trying to convey to me is, you know, in Japan, there are some people who are saying that, you know, the German Holocaust didn't exist, or the Nanking Massacre was, you know, over-exaggerated. And it might not be too far down the road before people say it never did happen.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important that we tell these stories and we keep, you know, get these books out and so forth. And just for our audience's help, can you tell a little bit about what occurred in Nanking? Because we're looking at 70 some years ago.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese had set up a puppet government in Manchuria and had decided to expand and actually take over China. And so they fought the Chinese army from Shanghai, were pushing them north up to the capital of Nanking. And back then they were trying to take, you know, the king, so to speak, like it's a chess game. And the king would be the capital, which was Nanking. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese resisted, and they fought this really, really fierce months-long battle retreating up to the city. And the Japanese, you know, army had kind of, you know, caught the cat in the bag, so to speak. And Nanking, you know, I've been there. I wanted to see firsthand myself what the city was like. And they had these just massive, massive thick walls that used to surround the whole city. So the Japanese army was trying to get through these gates, these massive walls, to capture the city, you know, to declare a victory. And the Chinese resisted. And what happened immediately afterwards was when the city fell, you know, there were, you know, all kinds of Chinese soldiers who threw away their uniforms, put on civilian uniforms, and there were Chinese who resisted to the end, and there were a lot of angry Japanese, and mayhem broke out in Nanking, mm-hmm. which resulted in a lot of people being killed and murdered. And so it's a very tragic black spot on the Japanese history. But Mr. Harada, you know, he openly mm-hmm. talked about it. He didn't try to hide that. He openly shared his experience there.
And that's what I think. That's what I thought was so important, Dan, was that when he talked about his disgust with what had occurred,
right? Yeah.
And how many of American veterans out there have witnessed similar things that occurred, and you're just going, well, I don't understand this. You know, we're supposed to be above all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've talked about the rules and laws of war, and
right.
sometimes they get thrown off to the side, unfortunately.
Yeah, he was, when I was talking to him, I could see his face get twisted in emotion. He was visibly upset. And this is 70 some odd years later. He's very upset, and unhappy about what happened. And you know, he says, you know, in war, there are no rules, there's no fairness, and people just go crazy. And it's a sad state that it seems like something we'll never be able to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
This is our nature.
So tell me a little bit more about Mr. Harada. How did he get involved in flying?
Well, Mr. Arata, you know, he's a really interesting person. He turned 96 last Saturday.
Oh, goodness.
He's the oldest living Japanese naval pilot who's been in combat.
Why?
And, you know, he was a young man, and he said he wanted to fly. But his parents were against it. It's too dangerous. So, you know, he joined the Navy as a regular seaman. He served aboard a destroyer. And finally got permission from the Navy to go to the enlisted aviation school. I think what most people don't realize is that nearly all of the Japanese pilots we encountered were enlisted then.
Right, that's so unusual, from our perspective.
What they would do in Japan is they took these young boys who were as early as 15 and a half, but usually 16, and they take them and put them in this aviation school. And then they would learn math and science, history, and they study their own language. They would study English, world history, and so they actually kind of went to high school while they're also learning how to fly. And from that group of boys, they would pick them and split them again and say, okay, well, this percentage is more suited to be pilots, and you all are going to be observers slash navigators, and the third group, you're going to be radiomen slash gunners. And then from there, they would go on to separate advanced schools to learn their skills. And these men, they're still, like, you know, seen in second class, and they're learning how to fly. And, you know, we have Japanese pilots who are, you know, these seamen first class, mm-hmm. Petty officers second class, and they're in combat at Midway, Guadalcanal, Pearl Harbor. It's almost like the Japanese, they looked at these teenage boys and said, okay, here's a lump of clay, and we're going to mold it into an aviator. But we're going to educate them as well. So, you know, these boys got the equivalent of what we think of as like maybe a junior college education by the time they graduated when they were 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were these, you know, and they've been taught that Japan, you know, was the ruler of the Asian, you know, area. And there's a lot of propaganda. And they all believed it, of course. You know, in the 1930s, you're living in Japan, there's no internet. There's no international radio. There's no television. There's no information from the outside world. And there's no, like, airliners taking tourists and people back and forth.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
So you have no contact with the outside world. And you believe what your own government and your own families and your own teachers teach you about the world and your own worldview.
That's for sure. We're talking with Dan King, author of the Last Zero Fighter here on Veterans Radio. And if you've got a question for Dan, give us a call here at 877-573-7825. I want to talk a little bit about Mr. Harada's, talk a little bit about the airplane that he started flying, because, you know, if we look at it from today's perspective, these guys were almost, you know, they were flying planes wrapped in cloth and made out of wood.
Right. Yeah, the first plane he ever flew in was a Type 3, and if you looked at it, it looks like something the Wright brothers had flown. It's ridiculous. I mean, for today's standards. But when he was at Nanking, he was flying a biplane, and he said that it performed excellent. There was no problems with it, and he liked it. But back then, I mean, a lot of countries were flying biplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually moved on to the Zero, which he loved. Oh, he could not stop talking about how much you love the Zero. He said it felt more like an extension of himself. And not, he didn't control the plane. Is it the key in the plane were as one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you thought that way, the plane performed just beautifully. And, you know, he said that the wildcats that they encountered were not really a problem for the Zero, the F-4F U.S. wildcat mm-hmm. fighters. But later on in the war, it was the Hellcats that really gave them trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Japanese, the Zero had no armor, none for the pilot, none for the engine, none for the fuel tanks. And it was really light and maneuverable. And it had, you know, the 20-millimeter cannons in the wing, which was historically brand new. And so those 20-millimeter cannons were like hand grenades. If those go off, those hit your plane, you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And being that the Zero was so light and nimble that it was really good in like kind of a python-like grappling with fighters. And that's what caused, you know, so many problems in the early days of the war, where our pilots would try to dogfight Japanese pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zeros could just turn in really tight and get on the, you know, our Wildcat's tails and knock him down. And Mr. Vada, he flew, after he got into the Zero, he didn't fly any other planes. He always flew with the Type 21 or the Type 52, but he just loved it.
What were some of the areas that he was involved?
Well, his first big Pacific War battle was Pearl Harbor, and he was stationed aboard the aircraft carrier Soryu. He was very excited about being involved in the actual attack on Hawaii, and several days before the attack, the mission brief went out, and he was scheduled to fly combat air patrol. And he was very sour about that. He was not happy.
Well, what would that entail?
And you know, the combat air patrol basically meant flying big circles around the fleet, mm-hmm. just in case an enemy aircraft came out. Well, you know, he was the first to take off from the Soryu early in the morning because he had to be in the air first. And he was part of a three-man, what they call a Shotai, an echelon. And, you know, the other carrier sent up combat air patrols as well. But he said he watched from the air as all these planes took off, these carriers, and slowly assembled in the sky. And he said he had tears of frustration, wanting to go on the raid, but wasn't allowed. Well, he you know, the Pearl Harbor attack went off, and, you know, we all know it's viewed as a sneak attack or a surprise attack. And Mr. Harada said that was another really big bone of contention with the Japanese naval pilots, because they were training for a proper war, and they were under the assumption that declaration had been declared by the time they would even get to Hawaii. And many of them, Mr. Yoshino, another pilot, another aviator who was at the Pearl Harbor attack, said that we thought that everything was declared and it was a lawful, correct attack.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they expected to not, many of them expected not to make it back to Japan. They figured they would strike Hawaii, and we would respond so quickly that they would probably sink two or three of our carriers in the process.
Right.
And so later, when they found out, you know, basically after the war, that we called it a sneak attack and a surprise attack, and they felt angry and humiliated, and they wanted answers from their own government. How do you do this to us? And now we, the Japanese people, bear the shame of being these, you know, sneaky people, the sneaky, you know, jerks, throughout history. They'll always be viewed as a sneak attack. But to the Japanese pilots, on December 7th, it was not a sneak attack. It was a lawful, proper attack mm-hmm. in their mind.
Well, he says a lot of different things. I love that this guy's comments are great when he's talking about the experiences that he had during World War II. And you know, as pilots, we all know that we lose friends and comrades as we go along through the service. And he lost mm-hmm. a lot of his fellow classmates.
He did. You know, when he was showing me these photos in his album, and I would say, well, how often do you get together? And he would say, on the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked so sad. I thought, wow, it's like looking at your high school photo and saying you're the only person alive from your whole high school. I mean, you know, for me. But he, you know, he lost. You know, there's several people who went down at Pearl Harbor. One of them was Lieutenant Fusata Iida. He crashed at Kaneohe Marine Base. And we actually went to his crash site 2 years ago. Mr. Harada and about 21 other Japanese and I, we visited Kaneohe, went to Lieutenant Iida's crash site, and Mr. Harada stood there at this memorial and talked about Iida, mm-hmm. how he knew him in China, and how they flew together, what kind of person he was. And I got goosebumps thinking, you know, I'm at this historic site talking to a man who actually knew this person.
It's an amazing story, Dan, and we're going to take a break here in a minute, and I want to come back and talk about some of these, more of these Japanese naval pilots. We're talking with Dan King, who's the author of The Last Zero Fighter, and we want you to give us a call. If you have a question or a concern, or you want to voice your opinion, call us at 877-573-7825. And when we come back on the other side, Dan, I want to talk about, and I'm trying to find it in the book, the code of honor that these pilots took when they became
right.
naval pilots. So we're going
right.
to take a break here a little bit early, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Dan King, The Last Zero Fighter. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Lieutenant Robert Nett was seriously wounded during hand-to-hand combat, but continued to lead his men. Details after this.
So you left college and didn't finish your degree. It doesn't mean it's out of reach. And don't let the time you spent in class go to waste. College credits can give you a head start in the Air Force, maybe an extra stripe or two. And you can continue your education with the Air Force Tuition Assistance Program. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Nett commanded Company E in an attack against a reinforced enemy battalion that had held up the American advance for 2 days from its entrenched positions around a three-story concrete building. With another infantry company and armored vehicles, Company E advanced against heavy machine gun and other automatic weapons fire, with Nett spearheading the assault against the strong point. During the fierce hand-to-hand encounter that ensued, he killed 7 deeply entrenched Japanese with his rifle and bayonet, and, although seriously wounded, continued to lead his men forward, refusing to relinquish his command. Again, he was severely wounded, but still unwilling to retire, pressed ahead with his troops to assure the capture of the objective. Wounded once more in the final assault, he calmly made all arrangements for the resumption of the advance, turned over his command to another officer, and then walked unaided to the rear for medical treatment. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
One of our planes was missing, 2 hours overdue. One of our planes was missing with all its gallant crew.
The radio sets were humming, they waited for a word. Then a voice broke through the humming, and this is what they heard. Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio, and we're talking with author Dan King, the author of the book The Last Zero Fighter. And I picked that little piece of music because, since I don't speak Japanese, I think there must have been a version of a song like that, more than likely. Because in your book, Dan, you talk about these pilots and when they would come back from missions and they were missing a wingman or something, and how they would just wait for them.
Yes, they're... You know, they would look towards the sky and wait, and they would have this hope that I thought was it symbols, you know, it's our human spirit, is when you're waiting for someone to come back. Okay, they'll return. I'll wait. And more often than not, they would not come back. And these pilots talked about how much they missed their friends. And, you know, and I thought, that's how an American would talk. That's how, you know, anybody would talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, the Japanese people are more like us than a lot of people admit. And one of the things that you mentioned just a moment ago was their code of honor. You know, I was a Boy Scout, right?
Yep. And, we all know that. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, and on down the line.
And they had something similar in the Japanese Army and Navy, if they had to memorize this oath. It was called Senjin Kun, and it was the imperial script. And it was enacted long before these men were even born. But it consists of 5 points, and the points are: the military man is loyal, polite, brave, trustworthy, and risky.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds very familiar to me.
Yes.
And they were all forced to memorize this, and many of them can still recite huge sections of this massive paragraph about being loyal, polite, brave, trustworthy, and thrifty.
There, when you mentioned that, I was thinking back to the book again, and I encourage people to get this if you really want to know something about what was happening on the other side during World War II, or what really happened at many of these battles, is that their training was pretty Spartan. When they say that, you know, the lessons were beat into them, sometimes these guys who, you know, would take a beating, just, you know, if they didn't memorize something, we used to just do push-ups. These guys would get hit with bats and things.
Mm-hmm. They had this short little, it looks something like a policeman's baton, the old style 1920s, you know, wooden policeman's baton. And they would take this brush, and they had written the word, to instill military spirit on this bat. And the instructors would carry it with them. And if someone made a mistake, or, you know, deserved punishment, and they would have these boys line up, face the wall, put their hands on the wall, and thrust their butts out. And this instructor would come along the line and give each boy a whack. I want to say, boy, these are like 16 and 17-year-old kids, right, going to training. Mm-hmm. And all of them went through it. And they would say, we didn't do anything wrong when we got the bat. And it was just part of the Japanese way of training. And there was also the roundhouse slaps, you know, punches in the face. And it just, you know, he said that there wasn't a day when someone or many of us had, you know, puffy eyes or fat lips during training.
One of the things that is kind of humorous to me, only as a pilot, I guess maybe that's what it was, but also the instructor pilots would have these little sticks that they would whack the guys on the head.
Right.
And tell me what the pilot, some of these young pilots would try to do to prevent that.
Well, yeah, I heard a story from a couple of different pilots. They would say that, you know, they were these biplane trainers, and the student is in the front, and then the pilot, the instructor's in the back, and they were nervous, and they were really hard on the rudder pedals and the stick, and they were just, you know, they're nervous, right? So the instructor in the back seat, you know, they didn't have these radios, so they talked to these speaking tubes mm-hmm. to each other. And oftentimes the instructor in the back seat would just take this long wooden little bat and reach forward in this open cockpit and knock the student on the top of his head to get his attention. And the students would form these little knots on their heads. So this one next day, the group of boys, you know, were smart, and they figured they'd stuff little hand towels up under their flight helmets. And, of course, the instructors caught on to that right away. Like, no one's ever thought of doing that before.
Right.
It lined all the boys up, and everyone got slapped. And the pilot was saying, you know, that wasn't such a smart idea after all. You can't get past these instructors.
I think that the thing that I really enjoyed about reading the book, The Last Zero Fighter, was to listen to these men talk about not only their experiences in the air but on the ground, and some of the, you know, the humorous things that they would do to let off steam, and you know, just, they're just boys, they're just young,
right,
young kids who have this extraordinary opportunity to be on a magic carpet and to,
right,
you know, and fly around in the air and have these things occur to them. So I'm amazed at that, the consistency and how similar it is, of course, to anybody who's ever been a pilot, that, you know, that you have that same sensation.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine, in some of these stories, I guess we should probably move ahead before we run out of time. You know, after Pearl Harbor, things didn't necessarily go quite as well for the Japanese naval pilots.
Right. You know, Mr. Harada moved on. He was involved in the Battle for Wake Island.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about that experience. And in the beginning, they were just full steamrolling over everybody. The Indian Ocean raids in Sri Lanka, Ceylon. Then we come to Midway, and Mr. Harada was involved in the Battle of Midway. And in 2010, we went to Hawaii to visit the crash site of Lieutenant Ida. We went to Midway Atoll.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Harada, they permitted him to go out on a little boat, the National Park Service, out to sea, and he placed wreaths and said prayers for the dead from both sides. And he wrote this little two-page prayer that I saw, and he mentioned in his prayer, prays for the souls of the American and the Japanese dead. But at Midway, Mr. Harada was heavily involved in combat air patrol again, and he thought that it would be a boring, long day because, the Japanese had planned to attack Midway, capture the island, land airplanes, create kind of a hammer and anvil effect, and when the Americans came out from Hawaii, you know, to support mm-hmm. to retake Midway, the Japanese would attack them from two sides. It was, in theory, a very good idea.
Well, one of the reasons for that, of course, from my history lesson, is that the carriers were not in Pearl Harbor, which was, you know, one of their main reasons for attacking Pearl Harbor was to get the aircraft carriers, but
right.
they were out at sea, and they were going to, you know, again, try the same thing on Wake mm-hmm. Island. How did they, from a historical standpoint, how did the Doolittle raid affect the morale of the Japanese pilots?
Oh, you know, that's the Doolittle raid comes up in Mr. Miyazaki's chapter.
Okay, we can go right over to Mr. Miyazaki.
Okay, Mr. Miyazaki, you know, every one of these pilots has a totally different personality. And, you know, you tend to generalize people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when you think of the Japanese, you think they're old and they're stern and they're, you know, they're curmudgeon, but, and some of them are. But all five men I interviewed were so different than Mr. Miyazaki. He had an amazing experience of being in the air over Doolittle, over the Raiders. He was in Yokosuka. He was flying combat air patrol over Yokosuka Bay on April 18, 1942. And he described seeing a pair of B-25s flying beneath him at about 1,500 feet. And it's an incredible, incredible story that he talks about.
What did he think? And I mean, it turned out it wasn't as big a surprise as we had hoped, but still, didn't he want to just zoom down on him?
Yeah, well, he was flying in a three-man echelon, so he wasn't the leader. So the leader chose not to fly down, so he didn't. I don't want to spoil it because it's a really interesting story.
Yeah,
Mr. Miyazaki, he got his interest in flight from watching an American Barnstormer show that came to Japan in the 1920s. And I think it's the Ivan Gates Flying Circus that he saw as a little boy. And his uncle took him. And he told me that he went to see this American Barnstormer show and watched these biplanes fly and these wing rockers, and one of them was a woman. And he told his uncle, he said, wow, if a woman can do something like that, then I can be a pilot too someday. And he said, from that moment on, I decided I'm going to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And then his next experience with Americans was at a church. And there was a lady in the neighborhood who worked for this American missionary. And because she worked in Queens with this family. And she invited all these local boys to come to the church for a Christmas service. And she promised them cake. So, hey, come on, what little kid can turn down cake, right? So he goes to the service, and he learns, hymns and Christmas songs, and he gets cake, and he watches the missionary's son play a song on a saw, Christmas songs, traditional Japanese songs on a saw. And he was just amazed. And so he told me, he said, my first two encounters with Americans were at the air show and at church. And he said, I had such a positive impression of the Americans, that they were brave, courageous, kind, friendly, and, they were happy people. He said, when the war broke out, my gut and feeling was, this is bad. These are not the people you want to fight against.
Mm-hmm.
These are good people. And every one of the veterans told me the same thing, is that after the war, they were somewhat surprised and grateful for the way that the Allies treated the Japanese. Because if it went the other way around, the Japanese government, the Japanese army, would not have been so benevolent. And as we've seen, they usually were not.
Right.
And they wanted to thank the American people. I didn't do anything. It's not, I wasn't born in 64 anyways. It wasn't like I did anything. But these veterans say thank you and thank your American people, for forgiving us and for rebuilding our country and being so, kind to us after the war.
I think that's important. We got about 2 minutes, Dan, before we're going to take another break. I'm talking with Dan King, author of The Last Zero Fighter. But I just wanted to have you tell us about if we hadn't gotten to Japan first, it would have been the Russians, and they were very nervous. The Japanese were very nervous about the Russians taking over Japan,
right,
because they knew that the treatment wouldn't be the same.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the things that several of the veterans said, that if the Russians were involved in the occupation, they were going to fight to the last man. And at this time in the war, in 1945, Mr. Harada found himself up in Hokkaido. He was training young kamikaze pilots to fly these rocket-powered aircraft called Shusui that the Japanese got from the Germans, the plans. And they had all decided if the Russians were involved in the occupation, they were going to take to the hills and they were going to fight this kind of guerrilla warfare. But when they learned that the Russians were not involved in the occupation, then they surrendered peacefully. They decided already to ignore, the emperor's warning, the emperor's cessation of hostilities announcement on August 15th. They were going to ignore that and keep fighting if the Russians were involved.
That's an important point for all of us to remember. And again, reading the book, many of the commanders said, put down your arms, don't take to the mountains and so forth. When we come back after our break, Dan, I want to talk a little bit about Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and the kamikaze pilot.
Okay.
So maybe we can get a real picture of that. We're talking with Dan King here on Veterans Radio. The Last Zero Fighter is the book, and you can find it at Amazon. But right now, we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the boys come home again, all over the world.
A universal theme. When the war is over, everybody gets to come home. I'm talking with Dan King, author of The Last Zero Fighter, and well, I really want to give away a lot of things that are in this book, but we can't do that because I encourage everybody to go and find this and read it. I want to read just a brief quote from General Snowden, who was the former company commander of the 23rd Marines 3rd Division on Iwo Jima. He says that we Americans do not hold a monopoly on courage and sacrifice. Our former adversaries, the Japanese, also displayed these qualities in their commitment to their nation. Mr. King has interviewed Japanese pilots and obtained their experiences in their own language, valuable to understanding the Japanese people who are now one of our closest and valuable allies. I encourage everyone who wishes to learn more about the World War II Pacific Theater to read this book. And Dan, I certainly echo those comments from General Snowden.
Thank you.
These pilots participated in events that we've only heard about, and they were actually there. Now, we've had other veterans on the program, American veterans who were pilots at Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and throughout the Pacific. But to hear this whole thing from the other side, I think is fascinating to me.
And, you know, for me to sit there in their houses and hear the stories, you know, oftentimes it was really hard for me to hear. Mm-hmm. I'm an American citizen, and these pilots are talking about shooting down Americans.
Right.
And, you know, I made the promise to them, because getting into their homes, getting into their lives was not easy. You can't just knock on their door and come in. It takes a lot of mutual trust. And I told them, I said, if you tell me something, I'll put it in my book. I'm not going to editorialize it. I'm not going to add my own opinions or comments. And I'm not going to judge you. What, if you tell me something happened, I will, of course, research it, and I'll put it in the book. And so when I'm sitting across from this man, and, for example, Mr. Yoshino, he's talking about dropping a torpedo on the USS Oklahoma on December 7th, Pearl Harbor. Right. And yeah, it was really gut-wrenching for me to hear. And he talks about his experience in getting attacked, I mean, getting shot at as they took off after dropping a torpedo. And Mr. Miyazaki is involved in Iwo Jima, 1944, long before we landed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, talks of battles that, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable for me to listen to, but I made a promise to them, is I think that this is important to capture their experiences, because, you know, 10 years from now, they'll all be gone for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Even the most hardiest of them.
I think one of the things that you did, Dan, so well, was that in your research, evidently, is that when you were able to find out the exact date of a conflict or a dogfight or however you want to word it, is that you would then put down that maybe who it was that they shot down or who their friends were shot down by.
Right.
Evidently, the Japanese and the Americans, I wasn't even aware of this, you know, the record-keeping of their after-action reports were amazing.
And many of the veterans had their original reports with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would flip through them, and they could show me they had departed at this certain time and returned at this certain time. And I was amazed to be able to hold these, to me, they're relics of history. And they're just, you know, in a closet in this man's house.
I think that's amazing. You talked about Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and when we were talking in our pre-program interview, one of the guests that's been on Veterans Radio in the past is Jerry Yellen, who is a Navy pilot for the Americans. And you know Jerry, and you also kind of met through his son.
Yes. I met his son in Japan, of all places, when we were talking to Mr. Maeda, who is a radio man on a Type 97 bomber that also attacked Pearl Harbor. And I found out that, you know, Mr. Yellen was a fighter pilot off of Iwo. And so we kind of talked about his experiences, and his son married a Japanese girl and lives in Japan. And you know, I think that's something that's very important to do is to forgive. We don't have to forget what happened. We shouldn't be asked to.
Right.
But when you look back at history and you can forgive the things that happened, it opens up your heart and it changes the way you think about things. And, I've met American veterans who've forgiven and they've moved past the war, and they're much happier than those who hold on to anger and resentment. And I've met Japanese veterans who hold on to anger and resentment as well, as opposed to those who've let it go. And they're just much happier people.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead?
No, sorry, go ahead.
One of those men was Mr. Imai Izumi. He's the man who had the monkey.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Mr. Imai Izumi, he passed away 6 weeks after I interviewed him. And it was heartbreaking to hear that he passed, because he was the most vibrant, energetic, happy-go-lucky person, of that age, that I'd ever met. And he went through some horrific experiences with the kamikaze escorts flying out of Hainan and Taiwan as well. And you really saw some horrible things. His friends die off in droves. And yet he looked back and he says, we were doing our duty. We were doing our best to protect our country. What more can you ask? And I thought, well, that's true. This is not an exact analogy, but I think it's close enough to kind of give you an understanding of what motivated the kamikaze pilots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I visited Guam this year, and a man told me, he said, you do know that the kamikaze pilots were welded into their cockpits, right? So they couldn't escape.
Oh, right. Yes,
and
I know. We know those stories.
I was like, are you kidding me? I thought, that's like saying, you do know in New York on 9/11 that the police had to point guns at the firemen to get them to go into the Twin Towers, right? Because the firemen wouldn't go in. The cops had to force them. It's like, no. The firemen on 9/11 and the kamikaze, I'm not saying they're the same. Don't get mad at me. I'm saying that their motivation, their deep core motivation was to save people. And the kamikaze's goal was to save their country from what they thought would be invasion and slavery.
Right.
And well, the story they were told.
Well,
yeah, they were told. Yeah.
Yeah, not all kamikaze pilots volunteered to be kamikaze pilots either.
Yes, many of them were forced to become pilots to like this group pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have 20 of your friends you've served with for 3-4 years line up in a row, and the commander says, anyone who wishes not to participate, step forward. Oh, that's, you know, and that the Japanese are a group mentality. It's hard to explain unless you've been there. But I lived there 10 years. And I've seen how strong the group mentality is. And if you ask one person to step forward to not volunteer, it won't happen. And they know that.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Imai Izumi, he escorted many, many kamikaze pilots to the deaths. So what they would do is they would send out a group of kamikaze pilots, and they would provide escorts whose job was not to really protect the kamikaze as so much to report on the results.
Right.
And they would have to take notes and say, okay, this plane missed and this plane hit. And he came back time and time again, you know, with this really heavy, you know, news to bring back. And not every kamikaze mission was successful, too. Oftentimes, intelligence was old, and they'd fly out to where the Americans are supposed to be, or the British are supposed to be, and there's no one there. They'd come back. Or they'd take off, and there's you know, heavy storms, cloud cover, and they couldn't find anyone. Or they had engine trouble.
I was going to say, and being human, they might have second thoughts and go, oh, I've got a little engine problem going on here, and oh, I can't find them. When we talked earlier, and our listeners know this story, is my dad was on an LST for Okinawa. He'd already been on Iwo Jima, and he was heading toward Okinawa when his LST was hit by a kamikaze pilot, and everybody ended up in the ocean. But and it took a long time, and I don't know if he ever really, you know, forgave, unfortunately. But there was, you know, and he just would never talk about it. And that, I think the idea behind the book, and I'm jumping around, I know that, because we're running, coming up to the end of the program, is that the point is that we want to get these veterans to tell their stories and get them down on paper or on a DVD or on a recording or whatever it happens to be, because they're so important. I think they're so important.
I think to know what happened firsthand from someone who actually saw the event and participated in the event, I think it's worth more than 1,000 books written by people like me or other people who've just, you know, read about it. But to actually talk to the actual veteran who was there at Pearl Harbor and Midway and Guadalcanal and the Philippines and Taiwan.
And sitting on a hillside watching the atomic bomb land.
The atomic bomb go off.
Right.
You know, Mr. Miyazaki and Mr. Kasai both found themselves in the 343 air group under Genda Minoru, or Minoru Genda, who planned the Pearl Harbor attack. Minoru Genda is the one who submitted the plans to Yamamoto for Pearl Harbor. And Mr. Miyazaki and Mr. Kasai, who's at the end of the book, both were in this super elite squadron of aces of the 301st, of the 343rd air group. And they find themselves just outside of Nagasaki on August 9th. And they see the atomic bomb go off. And they describe, you know, the moments before and right after that bomb went off. And to me, it's just, you know, to me, it's a black and white photo. But when you read the veterans' stories, it really comes alive.
It certainly does, Dan. And I think you've done a great job. And you know, we're coming up. We got about a minute left. I just want to encourage our listeners to go out and buy this book, The Last Zero Fighter. If you want to know what was going on in pilots' mind and what really was going on from their side at Wake Island, Marshall Island, I didn't even know that there was a, you know, that they were in the Indian Ocean. His research is so thorough that I really encourage people to. And the way that you wrote it, as you mentioned earlier, you know, your opinions are not in here. These are these men's lives that are on paper. And we all know that, you know, there are a lot of World War II veterans, and unfortunately most of them are going away. But this is an opportunity to see what it looked like from the other side. So, Dan, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I hope that we can have you on again in the future.
Thank you. And if I could close with one comment, say this is not revisionist history. This is just their experiences put on paper. I'm not trying to change history, cover up history. I'm presenting it to everyone as they presented it to me.
Absolutely. So that's what we always say. We want to get the stories out there before the historians mess it up.
Good.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I'll be in touch with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
There you go, folks. The Last Zero Fighter by Dan King. You can get it at all your local bookstores, Amazon.com. It's a great story. It just came out recently, and I think that you'll find it fascinating. Next week up on Veterans Radio, Dwight Zimmerman, award-winning author and author of his newest book about Lincoln and some other great things that he can talk to you about, will be on the program. Until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.